As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to the Game Podcast. I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and this week I'm joined by Matt Hughes, Tom Dart, and broadcasting from the Great Northeast, George Calkin. Today we'll be discussing Manchester United's comeback at Upton Park and also Arsenal's draw with Blackburn. We'll also be debating the merits of a national under-21 side playing in the Football League. What's that all about? So join us for 40 minutes or so of the best football conversation you'll hear all week, at least from me. Okay, so there was a point on Saturday when Manchester United were losing 2-0 at West Ham, and the chasing pack were no doubt all watching on television when I think we all thought, game on. Boy, were we wrong. Matt, when you're 2-0 down and you come back to win 4-2 and your comeback begins sort of half an hour from time and you haven't been playing well and you still get the 3 points, is this the intangible quality that we define as the stuff of champions?
I think it is, and also it's the stuff of Manchester United. They've done it for years and years under Fergie. I was at Blackpool a couple of months ago. They were 2-0 down, playing terribly. Somehow scored 3 goals in, I think, 14 minutes to win 3-2. And they've done it again and again. A couple of years ago, they were losing at home to Villa. A little kid called Makeda came on. No one had ever heard of him. Turn the game, and that they were champions that year as well. So it just goes to show that in the big games, that they really can get the result when needed.
George, I like to be sort of analytical and rational wherever possible.
Rational?
I like to think so.
Okay.
But, I mean, Hughesy just said there that this is what United do over and over again. Is there a pattern there, or is it just that... Actually, is it just coincidence and we just remember when United do it, but we don't remember when other teams do it?
No, I mean, I think there is. I mean, they've done it in so many sort of big occasions as well as sort of during routine matches. I mean, I think if there's anything slightly different about the game on Saturday is that they were actually playing pretty well from what I saw when going 2-0 down, and probably more importantly, West Ham looked pretty awful. So I don't think it was one of these sort of force of nature comebacks that goes against the grain. I think they just played the way they were, carried on and sort of kept calm and got there. It wasn't sort of a last minute winner. I think they just played. I think they just carried on how they were doing and got the result they deserved. But no, it is ingrained in them, this this sort of mentality that what you do is you win. And you can sort of look at other teams around the division at the moment. Some at the top, some at the bottom, who have the opposite, and it does become part of that history and heritage and part of the character. And it's not a made up quality. It's there and it's in abundance.
Hey, Tom, I agree with George actually that West Ham were playing pretty badly despite being 2-0 up. But that said, you're 2-0 up at home. There's half an hour ago. Hey, when you let a lead like that slip, do you deserve to stay in the Premier League?
Well, West Ham's defending has been their biggest problem of the season.
Despite the England international there.
Yeah. Yeah, of course, several, if you... Upson and Green.
Charitably not counting Bridge.
But no, let's not count Winbridge. I think they just buckled under the pressure. Rooney scored a fantastic goal. Presumably United got the hairdryer at half-time. Fergie chucked on a couple of strikers, so it was all out attack in the second half, redoubled their efforts, and I think any team would struggle to withstand that, let alone a team with such unconvincing defenders as West Ham. And there was also a dubious penalty when Fabio's pass hit Upson's arm, which shouldn't have been a penalty. So United did get help there as well. And that Giggs kind of mishit cross for the last goal as well, which was perhaps a bit fortunate. So United had a little bit of luck, but they also did make their luck with the force, which any team would have struggled to withstand that, not just West Ham.
Tom mentioned Wayne Rooney there. Obviously, I'm on the record saying this is, at the end, his worst season since coming to Old Trafford. And obviously, he's had a whole raft of off-the-pitch issues, which also made it difficult for him. But he's been playing better in the last month or so. Because we in the media are obsessed with finding turning points, is the hat-trick a turning point, or was it a turning point maybe a couple of weeks ago?
Yeah, I was impressed with the way he played against Marseille in the Champions League a couple of weeks ago, where he used the ball and brought others into play. And actually, unlike on Saturday, he kept his head in quite a tense situation. So he's been getting better for some time. It's sometimes quite easy to identify certain turning points, but I think when you've had a serious injury and particular problems, the form doesn't just click back. You've got to work at it, and he's been doing that, and hopefully will continue to improve throughout the remainder of the season.
George, a lot of people complain that we should have been celebrating Rooney's hat trick and blah blah blah, but instead it's going to get overshadowed by the fact that he swore into a camera after his goal. Now, I tried not to overshadow it, but I guess we need to talk about it. What's your take on this? I mean, I guess it's the kind of broad philosophical question that even my hairdresser could answer with one way or another. But footballers obviously get paid a lot of money. I don't want to get into the whole role model argument, but is there a moment in time when we can say, look, if you're going to swear on the pitch when nobody notices except for the referee and your teammates, that's your business, but that there's a camera there, you're running to the camera, the camera has a mic, please don't do this, and if you do this, we will punish you.
Well, I get kind of quite angry about things like this. I mean, if on the one hand, there's a move in football to have microphones right next to the pitch, cameras get in, we want to see things in 3D, we want to see things in incredible high definition pictures, so on and so forth, and then we complain when people do things or say things that we don't sort of like. And Wayne, we've talked a little bit about Wayne Rooney. He's had a difficult season. He's just scored a hat trick that arguably will be responsible for Man United winning the title. He's had an emotional moment within 10-15 seconds. A camera gets stuck right in his face, and he kind of explodes in an emotional and passionate way. And yes, he'd obviously sort of stepped over the line a little bit, but I'm not entirely sure what we're supposed to expect from him. And he's apologised straight afterwards. I think that's fair enough, and I think at that point we should move on, really. It's important that our stadiums are safe places and that there's no kind of prejudice whatsoever, but I don't want them to be sort of sanitised places as well. Supporters chant fairly robust things from the stand in every game we're at. It should be passionate, it should be emotional. Swearing is part of a rich language that we have. I'm not saying that it's acceptable in all its forms, but I do think this is a case of let's get on and talk about something else. Except not now, obviously, because we're going to carry on talking about it.
I'm afraid we will. I always get struck by people who make the women and children, people who are sort of offended and shocked by this language. And I take George's point on board. My kids aren't old enough to go to football, but if they were, I would kind of explain to them that you will hear this language, and it's because people get emotional, but it's not really appropriate language to be using. And I would imagine that as a parent, that's how you handle it. Matt, you're a parent, although I imagine you probably don't have experience with kids old enough to go to football yet. But should we?
She's been.
Oh, to Huddersfield.
Oh yeah. 12 weeks.
Rue, what'd you make of the industrial language?
Well, she was 12 weeks. She's not been back since. but, I mean, I think, like it or not, bad language is a part of football. So I don't think you can castigate Wayne Rooney for using language that probably 50, 60% of the people in the stadium would also be using.
But there's a difference, though, is that, you know, I'm not in the stadium. Wayne Rooney's in my living room. I mean, I think that's the obvious counter-argument you make, right?
Yeah, true. And he should try and temper his behaviour accordingly, but he doesn't choose to have the cameras that close to him, that close to the action. It's difficult, but I think it's not helped by the Premier League last week coming out and trying to make a political point. I was talking to someone from them on Friday, and they were saying they were going to encourage referees to show yellow cards for bad language and for aggressive behaviour just in the course of the game. For them to say that and then for Ryan Rooney to do what he's done the day later puts the FA in quite a difficult position. If they'd almost condoning it if they don't do anything. So it's because of the personality involved and how well known he is, it's almost a political issue that's taken on more significance than it deserves, really.
I love the fact that he was actually trying to have a conversation with an inanimate object as well. I mean, I thought that was quite impressive. What camera?
Come on! Yeah, I was rather impressed by that, and which also made me think there was a bit of some kind of play acting there. Were it a different person and not the way Wayne Rooney's been lampooned, I'd kind of feel like he was in on some kind of, you know, meta joke that he was playing on the population. Although, you know, given that Wayne Rooney presents himself a certain way, you kind of wonder that, you know, maybe he wasn't. Maybe it is as George says, he was having a conversation with an inanimate object, but. Tom, since I'm assuming nobody's going to stick up for the moralizers here, I guess I'm going to have to and play devil's advocate for a minute. TV money pays, if not the bulk, a big chunk of Wayne Rooney's wages. He is an actor in a TV drama, and he benefits financially from this tremendously. If he didn't want the cameras there, he could go off and, you know, play non-league football or something. But because he's part of this spectacle, and the TV broadcasters argue that part of the way we sell the spectacle for so much money which then goes back to Wayne Rooney and other professional footballers, is by having the high-definition cameras and the mics at pitch side and everything, and really bringing that experience to the people. Otherwise, we would just have one camera up high, and that would be that. Nobody would have any idea what the people are saying, but then Wayne Rooney probably would be making $130,000 a week or however much he makes. Do they have a case there? I mean, can they argue that they're somehow indirectly Wayne Rooney's employers and therefore demand that Rooney or any other footballer not swear into the camera, and if he does, then be punished?
I think so, yeah. I think given the amount of money they put into the game, that gives them a lot of power. We all know they can move the fixtures around more or less at will. So clearly, I think if this kind of thing suddenly becomes a problem for the TV companies and they find that their own brands, their own reputation and their own audience is being damaged by the behaviour of footballers, then clearly they will get involved at a higher extent.
Quite interesting, the sort of the you know, the incredible pulling power and power that TV has, and you know, we all work in the media, so we have a sort of part to play in this as well. But you get sort of far more stories from what managers say or what players do on the pitch, but you know, from what managers say directly after games in the first sort of few minutes when they're kind of full of adrenaline and emotion. And actually, you probably get a lot more respect in football if you said to managers, right, you're not allowed to say anything for an hour. I mean, it'd be horrible for newspaper deadlines, and it would be completely hopeless for TV. But take a step back, think about it for an hour, and then when you come out and talk about the game, you're going to be much more reasoned, and a lot of the time, anyway, you'll be much more reasoned and sort of reflective, and you would maybe get a much more kind of reasoned and reflective media discussion of the game in the process.
I'm not so sure about that, George. Often managers don't turn up until about an hour afterwards.
Flash quotes on television. You know, we saw Arsene Wenger after the Barcelona game. You know, a week or so ago, and same with Van Persie doing it then. If you actually sort of take a step back You know, take a step back, see the referee if you want. I mean, no, I agree. In some times of, you know, when there's been controversial decisions, managers are going to say controversial things. But anyway, but, you know, I do think that we have this sort of move for things to be quicker and instant and flash quotes and everything like that. And I do think that sort of piles more pressure on everybody connected to the game.
Matt, obviously this comeback, you know, is a kind of thing that sort of generates enthusiasm and adrenaline. Can it also make the difference for United in their midweek clash with Chelsea in the Champions League?
I wouldn't have thought so. I think these teams are both so experienced and successful over a number of years that they're big enough and mature enough to view these matches as standalone fixtures, really. I don't think that either team will take any momentum. United are probably going to win the league, yet Chelsea beat them at Stamford Bridge 3 weeks ago and also beat them at Old Trafford last year. So you can argue both ways. I think it's a fairly boring, obvious answer, but I think the best team will probably win.
Moving on to Arsenal and Blackburn, and Matt, and kind of related to this very point, I'm quoting now from Alison Rudd's piece, where she quotes Arsene Wenger as saying basically that Arsenal are at a disadvantage this season. And he says, and I quote, "There's a lot of things going on that I don't want to talk about. I've been here for 15 years and I know how things work, so I want to be completely neutral, like I have to be, because I'm not involved in any decision. I don't decide the schedule. You should ask the people who make the schedule. If you look, when do we play? We play every game from now until the end of the season on a Sunday." His basic point is that Arsenal play after Manchester United, although except for next week, I guess, when they play before them, and also May 1st when they play each other, so they're actually playing at the same time, unless United starts slowly, which is a different issue. When it comes to this, I mean, does Wenger also fall into this camp? I mean, is this kind of thing that, like, if you were, you know, Ivan Gazidis, you'd maybe take Wenger aside and say, "Listen, Arsenal, please, you're intelligent, you wear glasses, please cut this out because this isn't helping"?
Well, he should, really, doesn't it? Because on Saturday he sounded like a desperate man trying to clutch at a straw and seizing any excuse he can think of to explain the fact that it looks like it's going to be another year before Arsenal win a trophy. It's going to be 6 years in May. Will they be selling 10th anniversary memorabilia to, you know, record their last trophy win in 4 years' time? At the moment, you wouldn't bet it back against it, because they're a very accomplished team, but they look like they're the sort of team that can finish third or fourth every year, but not much else.
Well, what I don't get, though, is that, I mean, Arsenal have not beaten a top-flight team, no disrespect to Leyton Orient, since February 23rd, when they beat Stoke 1-0. That's across all competitions. I mean, that's awful for a team that's second in the table, isn't it?
It's bad, but there are factors to explain it. They were on a good run, and then they had that period of 7 days where they had the second leg against Barcelona and then a trip to Old Trafford in the FA Cup. And that very intense period, obviously the Carabao Cup final as well prior to that very intense period is clearly taking its toll. It went badly and they've been unable to recover. And I think now, despite the fact that they're still United's closest challengers, it doesn't look like they're going to put up much of a fight.
You know, none of the sort of teams at the top of the table have really kind of come on this season, and in most cases have probably declined a little bit. Man United, if you look at their most important players, you've got Vidic, Van der Sar, you know, one of the strikers up front. Chelsea, I know, have been sort of disappointing, but they still have that spine. And Arsenal are just not strong enough there. They don't have the players, in my opinion, to fall back on when things go against them, not just for one game, but for two or three games in a row. The keeper's not good enough. They haven't got a commanding centre-half. Fabregas has been injured for half the season. And Van Persie hasn't played enough games. So all the way through the middle of the team, they haven't had people that they can rely upon to sort of dig results out. I mean, this isn't a blinding statement. It's a statement of the obvious. But, you know, it surely has to be addressed.
I think it's quite instructive that probably maybe Nasri, but I would say Arsenal's best player this season has been Jack Wilshere, who is a 19-year-old.
Yeah.
Although a very talented 19-year-old boy, you shouldn't be relying on a 19-year-old to win you the Premier League. If you are, you're gonna have problems.
Tom, do you want to take the devil's advocate position that, you know, while it's easy to pick on Arsenal, the fact is they play the best football in the Premier League, and even in this game against Rovers, while they weren't really good, they took a million shots on goal at 110% of the possession, and basically, you know, Steve Keane, for all his Portuguese pedigree, basically laid out a team that, you know, put 10 guys in the box. Do you want to argue that point?
Yeah, you can argue that because it's true. I mean, it's true every week and it's true every season.
Well, they deserve to win every week, but they're unlucky because people are uber defensive?
No, that they create a lot of chances, play really exciting attacking football and miss a load of chances as well, and are always one of the teams you would want to watch. But for Arsenal fans and for those of us who would like to see Arsenal become genuine, proper, bona fide contenders, not pretenders who fade every spring, it's becoming a bit wearisome. I think this season, perhaps the loss to Birmingham City in the Carling Cup final was so traumatic, it's kind of set off an avalanche, and in 6 weeks they're more or less out of every trophy now, every competition, which is devastating. Perhaps it'll change Wenger's attitude in the summer when he buys some new players, perhaps not. It's just Wenger's stubbornness is perhaps one of the things that frustrates us most. For someone so smart, so brilliant, he doesn't seem to recognise what everyone else is shouting at him, doesn't seem to accept that, and so he's kind of doomed to repeat these disappointing mistakes year after year.
Matt, did you get the sense that a few years ago, maybe Wenger...
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with Plush Care. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Wenger was different. Maybe he was a bit less stubborn. I mean, statistically, I was surprised to find his current, even as most footballers get bigger and heavier, his current Arsenal side, his best 11, are substantially smaller and lighter than the team that won the double back in 97-98. Do you get the sense that he's become more stubborn and maybe he doesn't have a figure like David Dean who he respected football wise and who maybe could sometimes keep him in check or at least have a dialogue with him at the club anymore?
Well, it's certainly true that there is no one at Arsenal on the board who can engage in the debate with Arsene Wenger about the sort of players they're signing. In my view, that's probably sometimes it's a good thing. We bemoan the fact that Chelsea, Roman Abramovich and whichever of his Russian friends he's talking to that week signed the players. At Arsenal, you've got a football man running the show. I think the pivotal moment in the modern history of Arsenal is the decision to build the Emirates Stadium. It's great success off the pitch, but on it since then, they took the view to go down the path of developing their own players. And Wenger's view is that you don't sign 24 to 30-year-olds because you'll block the path of the players that have spent so much time and money trying to develop. My view would be it would be worth it if it was to deliver a couple of trophies, but he is adamant that they will not sign even very good players at the age range. They'll only sign exceptional players, and obviously exceptional players are difficult to find. Hence, he signs players like Squillaci and relies on Johan Jury to play at centre-back. I think it's misguided, but those are the principles in which he just decided to operate.
I want to dedicate a word to Blackburn, and I'd like George to tell us about it, since I'm sure he's been following the situation very, very closely. When you look in a crystal ball, what do you see?
Well, I see a very opaque future. I mean, I guess after a very difficult run of results, they did very well to come back from two goals down against Blackpool. They've just held Arsenal. So sort of short term, their position looks a lot more sturdy. Beyond that, it's very difficult to kind of make any sort of judgment, because the new owners have come in, changed things very quickly, and we simply don't know what they're going to be doing in the summer. Providing they do stay up. They've got a young manager. It's very difficult to see what strategy they've got from buying the club in the first place. I mean, you can make that observation about a lot of clubs in the Premier League, of course, with their owners, but the motivation behind it isn't entirely clear. And I don't know where they go from here. They're always going to have a limited sort of fan base in their hometown, because it's a small hometown. They're competing in the Northwest with some huge football clubs, and winning the championship is nigh on impossible. The top six is very, very difficult. But it's going to be fascinating. I think we're going to see some very, very interesting stories come out of Blackburn in the summer, simply because there's been tainted by a little bit of craziness so far. So I think it's going to be an interesting one to watch.
All right, now with our debate this week, we're going to get a little bit wacky, so I'd like you all to take a little bit of a leap of imagination. There's a proposal, and something like this exists in other sports and in other countries as well, but for the first time, a footballing power is really taking a look at this. And it's that in Italy, there's a proposal by the FA to basically create a team of players eligible for the under 21 cycle, players who would come on loan from other clubs on a voluntary basis, and basically play a season either in the second or third tier of Italian football. The idea would be, I guess, it would be something like turning Lillishall into a professional team, or what Lillishall used to be. Get a number of your best players who maybe struggle to find playing time, and allow them to grow together. And the evidence cited is that when Mr. Peter Crouch was, I think, 18 or 19 years old, he was at Spurs. Spurs thought that he was a big, tall freak who was rubbish and who couldn't play, and they sold him to QPR for, I think, 50 or 100 grand. But mainly because they didn't have the time or the opportunity to develop him, and he was getting too old to give him a proper contract. And so maybe a guy like Peter Crouch might have been somebody who would not have fallen through the cracks if at youth level there'd been a place for him to play. George, I want to start with you. I think Newcastle a few years ago, if I'm not, maybe 12 years ago, they got rid of their reserve team, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no indication it's going to happen. That's going to happen again. Getting rid of reserve teams, but do you see a case with maybe clubs becoming less patient with players in that sort of 19 to 21 age bracket? And could something like this offer a solution?
Well, I mean, to answer the first point, I mean, it's, Tottenham, there were specific reasons why Newcastle got rid of the reserve team. That was because at the time there was a directive that a certain amount of games had to be played on the sort of home stadium, so in that case St James's Park, and Kevin Keegan, it was a very short-sighted move, but Kevin Keegan rejected that, and that was why they did that. I mean,
so was this a directive from the league?
It was at the time, yeah. That I don't know whether it's 50% or
it's kind
whatever.
Of stupid.
But
well, who are they to go tell the clubs what to do with the reserve teams?
Yeah. But you know, the thing is, where Tottenham, there's a couple of points where Tottenham were in their history when Crouch came through. You know, the problem for all young players at the kind of the bigger teams is that they have to find a way through some really, really good players, and that's you know, that's always going to be a struggle. There isn't this sort of there isn't necessarily a direct route to the team. That's why clubs like, you know, Manchester United, particularly Arsenal, dispatch their players out on loan to either other Premier League clubs or Football League clubs and let them grow and develop there. And that's supposedly the point of the system. And you look at somebody like Danny Welbeck at Sunderland, who's presumably wouldn't get anywhere near the United team this season, but has done very well at Sunderland, thrived, and if he does go back this summer, he will be going back a far more complete, rounded footballer, and the system should be doing, you know, the system should be doing that. I mean, I'm not, you know, obviously I want the England team to do well and the under 21 team to do well, but I'm very I have to say my sort of instincts are sort of to be against a system which, you know, turns our sort of heritage and league format on its head. You know, it's about local teams and that represent towns and cities. It's about history. It's about our sporting culture. And to kind of artificially put a club, you know, a sort of invented club in there to do what the system should be doing in the first place. And I admit it's not always successful. I would be very cautious about.
Yeah, Matt, that is the price you pay. You know, you lose. I guess in some ways, even the competitive integrity of the division that would host this sort of, you know, center of excellence, FA or whatever you want to call it. But I wanted to ask you about George's point about the loan system. I mean, when it works, great. You know, the guy gets experience and he grows. But I think what sometimes happens is, well, two things. One is you loan a guy to a team for a player. If it was, I'll take that again. But what sometimes happens is this, you know, you loan a player to a team for a season and, you know, maybe the manager changes or the new guy doesn't really like him. So maybe he doesn't get the training that you expect or the medical attention you expect. Maybe he just gets overlooked. You know, there's a lot of things that can go wrong. And ultimately, the club that takes him on loan often doesn't really have an incentive to develop the player as well, especially if it's, you know, a slightly more marginal player or maybe more of a late bloomer than say, Danny Welbeck. Are you satisfied that the loan system does enough? Or is there any way that it can be improved?
I think the loan system generally works fairly well and can suit both parties. I think it needs to be tweaked in so much that a player should go on loan for the whole season or maybe half a season and you could have a break in the January transfer window. I don't like these situations where players move back and forth and back and forth and it's not quite clear who's looking after the player's best interests, and even if there are sort of malign reasons for exploiting the system whereby you recall a player so he can't play against some of your rivals and things like that. I mean, you talked about Welbeck. I think Jack Wilshere is one player who clearly benefited from playing at Bolton for the last 4 months of last season and has come back a completely different player. So I think it can work, and it's a structure that enables the league system to exist in its current kind of organic form. I would resist meddling with it in what is admittedly quite an interesting proposal. I think the great strength of the English game, its club structure and its strength and depth, that's why there were 40,000 people watching Brentford Carlisle at Wembley yesterday, and to tinker with that for something that might produce more players is a huge risk, and I would say it's too big a price to pay.
Tom?
Yeah, I agree to tamper with the integrity of the Football League and disrespect clubs who strive for promotion by plunking some kind of, you know, Harlem Globetrotters with acne style teenage all-star team into whichever division, just and then have this artificial club basically exist to benefit the Premier League while being in the Football League. Presumably it couldn't get promoted all the way, so you'd have issues with
integrity. It's to benefit England, not the Premier League. England.
I think the loan system is fine as it is. Absolutely fine as it is, and I don't think there's any need to tamper with it. And all you'd find anyway is a team full of 18 or 19 year olds would end up getting bullied off the ball and harried and physically intimidated by the stronger, older, wiser sides in the Football League. So I think it would not help. The best way is for Premier League talent to go into smaller Premier League teams or the Championship, and then they can develop alongside experienced players and get an understanding of a winning mentality from by learning from clubs who really need to win and desperate to win rather than...
I mean, what you also want is for clubs themselves, I mean, further down the chain to sort of take or, you know, have the time to take their academies, their youth teams sort of seriously. I mean, there's an example near me which is sort of interesting in terms of what they're going through. You know, obviously Middlesbrough were a Premier League team for a long time. They battered above their weight, produced some fantastic players. You can see in whether it's Stuart Downing or Johnson or slightly lesser Catamol and David Wheater, but they also have produced people like James Morrison and Chris Brunt at West Brom. Danny Graham scoring a lot of goals at Watford, and he had to go off on a journey to Carlisle and other places before actually developing enough to sort of play in the Championship. And obviously all of those players would now walk into the Middlesbrough team. They've gone through a horrific season and they've got tough times ahead, and they're going to have to reduce their wage bill from £20 million this season, which is very large, to £6 million next season, just to kind of keep their heads above water. But at the same time, because they've invested in their academy, about seven of their players who played at the weekend came through the academy, and they've got an advantage because they've got such a sort of good pool of local talent coming through. Now that's maybe won't be enough for them to get back into the Premier League or get promotion, but they've got a head start because they've taken the time to sort of invest in that in that side of the club. And you kind of like more clubs to have the sort of the wit but also the time and the money to do the same thing.
Wait, George, this isn't said that they have to reduce their wage bill from 20 million to 6 million. Can they not just go and invoice Gordon Strachan, make him pick up some of the tab for all those old Scottish guys he brought in?
Well, they took a hell of a gamble. You know, they would admit that themselves. They already went for it in the summer, and they went sort of down the wrong road, unfortunately. You know, for them, they brought in, you know, they did bring in Scottish players. I mean, I know what Strachan was trying to do. It was to go for experience
and win the SPL.
And, well, you know, cheap, but players that he thought were hungry because they would have something to prove, relatively low wages, although very high wages for the Championship. If you look at people like Chris Boyd and McManus and Scott McDonald and people like that, and it just hasn't worked. It hasn't worked at all. So they're going to have to go back to square one and look at the kids again.
Okay, enough. That just concludes our brief Middlesbrough Strachan interlude. But I asked you about it. We have all this TV money. Can we use some of it to incentivize clubs to do things that would be desirable for the English game and ultimately England? And maybe one of those things is, you know, if you give more playing time to, you know, the next David Wheater rather than, you know, then go out and give yet another contract to a 35 or 36-year-old guy who will cost more money and won't be part of England's future.
Why are we so obsessed with England's future? I mean, I don't see why we should tell
clubs.
There's
another person
I don't see why
who
should...
hates the England team. Calkin, you're the only England fan here. You realize that?
No, I'm not.
Yes, you are. Tom
no,
hates
I mean,
the England
no, I'm
team.
Not an England fan.
What?
Am I? Okay. What have I said that's pro-England?
You did say before that you wanted the England team to do well. I'm really going to bother
asking
Hughes
that
question.
That's not exactly nailing my colours to the mast, saying I'm going to get a Union Jack tattooed on my forehead and, whatever.
Tom, please continue your anti-England rant.
Well, the England team is always in the top 10 teams in the world, and the rest of that, whether it progresses any further in tournaments, is just down to the manager. I don't think we should become obsessed with telling clubs what they can and can't do. If they want to play a 36-year-old, then why not? It's always going to be in the interests of clubs to develop young players, and we've seen Premier League clubs getting their tentacles far more deeply into this and developing school programs. Championship clubs as well, like Watford, have got extremely extensive and ambitious youth development programs. It's always going to be in the club's interest to find a couple of young talents who they can then develop, play or sell on for vast profits. So I don't see any fundamental problems with the system.
Tom makes two very good points. Firstly, we only care about England once every two or three months, certainly once every 2 years, 4 years. There isn't a will, I don't think, in football at large to sort of change things so deeply. We care about it when it suits us, but the rest of the time we put it on the back burner and care what our clubs are doing. Secondly, whatever we do, England are only ever going to get to the quarterfinals. So,
Mr. Negativity again. Okay, how about some quick hits? Stoke put Chelsea through the ringer and probably deserve more than a point. Matt, is it just about the Champions League now for Ancelotti? And since we haven't heard your personal verdict on Torres just yet, when, if ever, is he going to regain his mojo?
I think it's been about the Champions League for Ancelotti since Christmas, really, which is why this is such a huge, huge week coming up. And after Torres, he's going to be back in the starting lineup against United, I think. But he still seems to be playing from memory for me, and I don't think it'll be till next season at the earliest, if ever, if he comes back to the player he was.
Newcastle hosts Wolverhampton Wanderers and romp to 4-1 win. George, even without Andy Carroll, Newcastle are still carefree in mid-table. Are any of the anti-Pardew brigade eating humble pie, or does it really not have much to do with Pards at all?
Well, firstly, mid-table is anything but carefree in the Premier League this season. And, you know, before their very, very good win over Wolves, they had lost fairly horribly at Stoke a couple of weeks before and had only won 1 in 10 games. So, big relief to get that result on Saturday. They can start now looking up rather than down, but their position in the league is secure, but not much else.
And it's all down to Alan Pardew.
They were 12th when they sacked Chris Hughton. They're 9th now.
Ha! Chris Hughton. Fraud. Pardew's much better, clearly. Tottenham Hotspur warmed up for their trip to the Bernabeu by drawing 0-0 at Wigan. Tom, Spurs were extremely dull. Was Redknapp saving Crouch, Lennon and Cranchar for the Champions League? Or should Tottenham fans be worried?
I think they should be worried. Spurs looked like they were wading through wet concrete for most of this game. Crouch came on near the end, missed a couple of chances, Lennon as well. They look really weary, Spurs. Of course, they had their minds on the big game against Real Madrid, but without Van der Vaart playing well, as he hasn't done for a couple of perhaps weeks and months now, I'm not sure who's getting the goals for Spurs. Perhaps it'll be different in Europe, but I fear that Real will beat them. Gab, one for you. Jose Mourinho's home league unbeaten streak came to an end on Saturday night. Please place the 9-year-plus sequence in historical context for us.
Well, you're asking for historical context there, Tom. And I think a streak like this, in some ways, it doesn't really tell you, much, because frankly, he lost plenty of home games in those 9 years because he's only human and it's normal. He just didn't lose them in the league. But what it does tell you is that, you know, in the 7 full seasons of management, he won the league 6 times, probably won't win it this year. But when you win leagues, it's often based on not dropping points at home, and that's what he's done. That's all we've got time for today. But remember, you can go to www.thetimes.co.uk. You'll find your news, your gossip, your analysis, your web chats. Mine is every Monday. Then you can also hear Ollie Kay and Patty Barkley and Graham Spears on different days of the week. And you can also follow us on Twitter. I'm on there, at Marcotti. Tom, what's your Twitter handle?
At Tom.Times.
At Tom.Times. There you go. Nice and snappy.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.